skills are so impressive that they're frightening. He made his life in Chicago, a dense metropolis, and he conducts himself with a confidence that comes from knowing that the modern American meritocracy was built for him. Of course, Obama overcame adversity in his own right, adversity familiar to many of us, but that was long before any of us knew him. President Obama came on the scene right as so many people in my community began to believe that the modern American meritocracy was not built for them. We know we're not doing well. We see it every day in the obituaries for teenage kids that conspicuously admit the cause of death, reading between the lines, overdose, and the deadbeats we watch our daughters waste their time with. Barack Obama strikes at the heart of our deepest insecurities. He is a good father while many of us aren't. He wears suits to his job while we wear overalls if we're lucky enough to have jobs at all. His wife tells us that we shouldn't be feeding our children certain foods, and we hate her for it, not because we think she's wrong, but because we know she's right. Many try to blame the anger and cynicism of working-class whites on misinformation. Admittedly, there is an industry of conspiracy mongers and fringe lunatics writing about all manner of idiocy, from Obama's alleged religious leanings to his ancestry. But every major news organization, even the oft-maligned Fox News, has always told the truth about Obama's citizenship status and religious views. The people I know are well aware of what the major news organizations have to say about the issue. They simply don't believe them. Only 6% of American voters believe that the media is very trustworthy. To many of us, the free press, that bulwark of American democracy, is simply full of shit. With little trust in the press, there's no check on the internet conspiracy theories that rule the digital world. Barack Obama is a foreign alien actively trying to destroy our country. Everything the media tells us is a lie. Many in the white working class believe the worst about their society. Here's a small sample of emails or messages I've seen from friends or family. From right-wing radio talker Alex Jones on the 10-year anniversary of 9/11, a documentary about the so-called unanswered questions of the terrorist attacks, suggesting that the U.S. government played a role in the massacre of its own people. From an email chain, a story that the Obamacare legislation requires microchip implantation in new healthcare patients. This story carries extra bite because of the religious implications. Many believe that the end times mark of the beast, foretold in biblical prophecy, will be an electronic device. Multiple friends warned others about this threat via social media. From the popular website WorldNet Daily, an editorial suggesting that the Newtown gun massacre was engineered by the federal government to turn public opinion on gun control measures. From multiple internet sources, suggestions that Obama will soon implement martial law in order to secure power for a third presidential term. The list goes on. It's impossible to know how many people believe one or many of these stories. But if a third of our community questions the president's origin, despite all evidence to the contrary, it's a good bet that the other conspiracies have broader currency than we'd like. This isn't some libertarian mistrust of government policy, which is healthy in any democracy. This is deep skepticism of the very institutions of our society, and it's becoming more and more mainstream. We can't trust the evening news. We can't trust our politicians. Our universities, the gateway to a better life, are rigged against us. We can't get jobs. You can't believe these things and participate meaningfully in society. Social psychologists have shown that group belief is a powerful motivator in performance. When groups perceive that it's in their interest to work hard and achieve things, members of that group outperform other similarly situated individuals. It's obvious why. If you believe that hard work pays off, then you work hard. If you think it's hard to get ahead even when you try, then why try at all? Similarly, when people do fail, this mindset allows them to look outward. I once ran into an old acquaintance at a Middletown bar who told me that he had recently quit his job because he was sick of waking up early. I later saw him complaining on Facebook about the Obama economy and how it had affected his life. I don't doubt that the Obama economy has affected many, but this man is assuredly not among them. His status in life is directly attributable to the choices he's made, and his life will improve only through better decisions. But for him to make better choices, he needs to live in an environment that forces him to ask tough questions about himself. There is a cultural movement in the white working class to blame problems on society or the government, and that movement gains adherence by the day. Here is where the rhetoric of modern conservatives, and I say this as one of them, fails to meet the real challenges of their biggest constituents. Instead of encouraging engagement, conservatives increasingly foment the kind of detachment that has sapped the ambition of so many of my peers. I have watched some friends blossom into successful adults and others fall victim to the worst of Middletown's temptations: premature parenthood, drugs, incarceration. What separates the successful from the unsuccessful are the expectations that they had for their own lives. Yet the message of the right is increasingly, it's not your fault that you're a loser, it's the government's fault. My dad, for example, has never disparaged hard work, but he mistrusts some of the most obvious paths to upward mobility. When he found out that I had decided to go to Yale Law, he asked whether, on my applications, I had pretended to be black or liberal. This is how low the cultural expectations of working-class white Americans have fallen. We should hardly be surprised that as attitudes like this one spread, the number of people willing to work for a better life diminishes. The Pew Economic Mobility Project studied how Americans evaluated their chances at economic betterment, and what they found was shocking. There is no group of Americans more pessimistic than working-class whites. Well over half of blacks, Latinos, and college-educated whites expect that their children will fare better economically than they have. Among working-class whites, only 44% share that expectation. Even more surprising, 42% of working-class whites, by far the highest number in the survey, report that their lives are less economically successful than those of their parents. In 2010, that just wasn't my mindset. I was happy about where I was and overwhelmingly hopeful about the future. For the first time in my life, I felt like an outsider in Middletown, and what turned me into an alien was my optimism. Chapter 12. During my first round of law school applications, I didn't even apply to Yale, Harvard, or Stanford, the mythical top three schools. I didn't think I had a chance at those places. More important, I didn't think it mattered. All lawyers get good jobs, I assumed. I just needed to get to any law school, and then I'd do fine. A nice salary, a respectable profession, and the American dream. Then my best friend Daryl ran into one of his law school classmates at a popular DC restaurant. She was bussing tables, simply because that was the only job available to her. On the next round, I gave Yale and Harvard a try. I didn't apply to Stanford, one of the very best schools in the country, and to know why is to understand that the lessons I learned as a kid were sometimes counterproductive. Stanford's law school application wasn't the standard combination of college transcript, LSAT score, and essays. It required a personal sign-off from the dean of your college. You had to submit a form, completed by the dean, attesting that you weren't a loser. I didn't know the dean of my college at Ohio State. It's a big place. I'm sure she's a lovely person, and the form was clearly little more than a formality, but I just couldn't ask. I had never met this person, never taken a class with her, and most of all, didn't trust her. Whatever virtues she possessed as a person, she was, in the abstract, an outsider. The professors I'd selected to write my letters had gained my trust. I listened to them nearly every day, took their tests, and wrote papers for them. As much as I loved Ohio State and its people for an incredible education and experience, I could not put my fate in the hands of someone I didn't know. I tried to talk myself into it. I even printed the form and drove it to campus. But when the time came, I crumpled it up and tossed it in the garbage. There would be no Stanford Law for JD. I decided that I wanted to go to Yale more than any other school. It had a certain aura, with its small class sizes and unique grading system. Yale billed itself as a low-stress way to jumpstart a legal career. But most of its students came from elite private colleges, not large state schools like mine, so I imagined that I had no chance of admission. Nonetheless, I submitted an application online because that was relatively easy. It was late afternoon on an early spring day, 2010, when my phone rang and the caller ID revealed an unfamiliar 203 area code. I answered, and the voice on the other line told me that he was the director of admissions at Yale Law, and that I'd been admitted to the class of 2013. I was ecstatic and leaped around during the entire 3-minute conversation. By the time he said goodbye, I was so out of breath that when I called Aunt Wee to tell her, she thought I'd just gotten into a car accident. I was sufficiently committed to going to Yale Law that I was willing to accept the $200,000 or so in debt that I knew I'd accrue. Yet the financial aid package Yale offered exceeded my wildest dreams. In my first year, it was nearly a full ride. That wasn't because of anything I'd done or earned. It was because I was one of the poorest kids in school. Yale offered tens of thousands in need-based aid. It was the first time being so broke paid so well. Yale wasn't just my dream school, it was also the cheapest option on the table. The New York Times recently reported that the most expensive schools are, paradoxically, cheaper for low-income students. Take, for example, a student whose parents earn $30,000 per year. Not a lot of money, but not poverty level either. That student would pay $10,000 for one of the less selective branch campuses of the University of Wisconsin, but would pay $6,000 at the school's flagship Madison campus. At Harvard, the student would pay only about $1,300 despite tuition of over $40,000. Of course, kids like me don't know this. My buddy Nate, a lifelong friend and one of the smartest people I know, wanted to go to the University of Chicago as an undergraduate, but he didn't apply because he knew he couldn't afford it. It likely would have cost him considerably less than Ohio State, just as Yale cost considerably less for me than any other school. I spent the next few months getting ready to leave. My aunt and uncle's friend got me that job at a local floor tile distribution warehouse, and I worked there during the summer, driving a forklift, getting tile shipments ready for transport, and sweeping a giant warehouse. By the end of the summer, I'd saved enough not to worry about the move to New Haven. The day I moved felt different from every other time I'd moved away from Middletown. I knew when I left for the Marines that I'd return often, and that life might bring me back to my hometown for an extended period. Indeed, it did. After 4 years in the Marines, the move to Columbus for college hadn't seemed all that significant. I'd become an expert at leaving Middletown for other places, and each time I felt at least a little forlorn. But I knew this time that I was never really coming back. That didn't bother me. Middletown no longer felt like home. On my first day at Yale Law School, there were posters in the hallways announcing an event with Tony Blair, the former British Prime Minister. I couldn't believe it. Tony Blair was speaking to a room of a few dozen students? If he came to Ohio State, he would have filled an auditorium of 1,000 people. Yeah, he speaks at Yale all the time, a friend told me. His son is an undergraduate. A few days after that, I nearly bumped into a man as I turned a corner to walk into the law school's main entrance. I said, "Excuse me," looked up, and realized the man was New York Governor George Pataki. These sorts of things happened at least once a week. Yale Law School was like nerd Hollywood, and I never stopped feeling like an awestruck tourist. The first semester was structured in a way to make life easy on students. While my friends in other law schools were overwhelmed with work and worrying about strict grading curves that effectively placed you in direct competition with your classmates, our dean asked us during orientation to follow our passions, wherever they might lead, and not worry so much about grades. Our first four classes were graded on a credit-no-credit basis, which made that easy. One of those classes, a constitutional law seminar of 16 students, became a kind of family for me. We called ourselves the Island of Misfit Toys, as there was no real unifying force to our team. A conservative hillbilly from Appalachia, the super smart daughter of Indian immigrants, a black Canadian with decades worth of street smarts, a neuroscientist from Phoenix, an aspiring civil rights attorney born a few minutes from Yale's campus, and an extremely progressive lesbian with a fantastic sense of humor, among others. But we became excellent friends. That first year at Yale was overwhelming, but in a good way. I'd always been an American history buff, and some of the buildings on campus predated the Revolutionary War. Sometimes I'd walk around campus searching for the placards that identified the ages of buildings. The buildings themselves were breathtakingly beautiful, towering masterpieces of neo-Gothic architecture. Inside, intricate stone carvings and wood trim gave the law school an almost medieval feel. You'd even sometimes hear that we went to HLS, Hogwarts Law School. It's telling that the best way to describe the law school was a reference to a series of fantasy novels. Classes were hard and sometimes required long nights in the library, but they weren't that hard. A part of me had thought I'd finally be revealed as an intellectual fraud, that the administration would realize they'd made a terrible mistake and send me back to Middletown with their sincerest apologies. Another part of me thought I'd be able to hack it, but only with extraordinary dedication. After all, these were the brightest students in the world, and I did not qualify as such. But that didn't end up being the case. Though there were rare geniuses walking the halls of the law school, most of my fellow students were smart but not intimidatingly so. In classroom discussions and on tests, I largely held my own. Not everything came easy. I always fancied myself a decent writer, but when I turned in a sloppy writing assignment to a famously stern professor, he handed it back with some extraordinarily critical commentary. "Not good at all," he scribbled on one page. On another, he circled a large paragraph and wrote in the margin, "This is a vomit of sentences masquerading as a paragraph. Fix." I heard through the grapevine that this professor thought Yale should accept only students from places like Harvard, Yale, Stanford, and Princeton. It's not our job to do remedial education, and too many of these other kids need it. That committed me to change his mind. By the end of the semester, he called my writing excellent and admitted that he might have been wrong about state schools. As the first year drew to a close, I felt triumphant. My professors and I got along well, I had earned solid grades, and I had a dream job for the summer, working for the chief counsel for a sitting U.S. senator. Yet for all the joy and intrigue, Yale planted a seed of doubt in my mind about whether I belonged. This place was so beyond the pale for what I expected of myself. I knew zero Ivy League graduates back home. I was the first person in my nuclear family to go to college, and the first person in my extended family to attend a professional school. When I arrived in August 2010, Yale had educated two of the three most recent Supreme Court justices and two of the six most recent presidents, not to mention the sitting Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton. There was something bizarre about Yale's social rituals. The cocktail receptions and banquets that served as both professional networking and personal matchmaking events. I lived among newly christened members of what folks back home pejoratively called the elites, and by every outward appearance, I was one of them. I am a tall, white, straight male. I have never felt out of place in my entire life, but I did at Yale. Part of it has to do with social class. A student survey found that over 95% of Yale Law students qualified as upper middle class or higher, and most of them qualified as outright wealthy. Obviously, I was neither upper middle class nor wealthy. Very few people at Yale Law School are like me. They may look like me, but for all of the Ivy League's obsession with diversity, virtually everyone, black, white, Jewish, Muslim, whatever, comes from intact families who never worry about money. Early during my first year, after a late night of drinking with my classmates, we all decided to stop at a New Haven chicken joint. Our large group left an awful mess. Dirty plates, chicken bones, ranch dressing and soda splattered on the tables, and so on. I couldn't imagine leaving it all for some poor guy to clean up, so I stayed behind. Of a dozen classmates, only one person helped me, my buddy Jamil, who also came from a poorer background. Afterward, I told Jamil that we were probably the only people in the school who'd ever had to clean up someone else's mess. He just nodded his head in silent agreement. Even though my experiences were unique, I never felt like a foreigner in Middletown. Most people's parents had never gone to college. My closest friends had all seen some kind of domestic strife in their life. Divorces, remarriages, legal separations, or fathers who spent some time in jail. A few parents worked as lawyers, engineers, or teachers. They were rich people to Mamaw, but they were never so rich that I thought of them as fundamentally different. They still lived within walking distance of my house, sent their kids to the same high school, and generally did the same things the rest of us did. It never occurred to me that I didn't belong, even in the homes of some of my relatively wealthy friends. At Yale Law School, I felt like my spaceship had crashed in Oz. People would say with a straight face that a surgeon mother and engineer father were middle class. In Middletown, $160,000 is an unfathomable salary. At Yale Law School, students expect to earn that amount in the first year after law school. Many of them are already worried that it won't be enough. It wasn't just about the money or my relative lack of it. It was about people's perceptions. Yale made me feel, for the first time in my life, that others viewed my life with intrigue. Professors and classmates seemed genuinely interested in what seemed to me a superficially boring story. I went to a mediocre public high school, my parents didn't go to college, and I grew up in Ohio. The same was true of nearly everyone I knew. At Yale, these things were true of no one. Even my service in the Marine Corps was pretty common in Ohio, but at Yale, many of my friends had never spent time with a veteran of America's newest wars. In other words, I was an anomaly. That's not exactly a bad thing. For much of that first year in law school, I reveled in the fact that I was the only big Marine with a Southern twang at my elite law school. But as law school acquaintances became close friends, I became less comfortable with the lies I told about my own past. My mom is a nurse, I told them. But of course that wasn't true anymore. I didn't really know what my legal father, the one whose name was on my birth certificate, did for a living. He was a total stranger. No one, except my best friends from Middletown, whom I asked to read my law school admissions essay, knew about the formative experiences that shaped my life. At Yale, I decided to change that. I'm not sure what motivated this change. Part of it is that I stopped being ashamed. My parents' mistakes were not my fault, so I had no reason to hide them. But I was concerned most of all that no one understood my grandparents' outsized role in my life. Few of even my closest friends understood how utterly hopeless my life would have been without Mamaw and Papaw. So maybe I just wanted to give credit where credit is due. Yet there's something else. As I realized how different I was from my classmates at Yale, I grew to appreciate how similar I was to the people back home. Most important, I became acutely aware of the inner conflict born of my recent success. On one of my first visits home after classes began, I stopped at a gas station not far from Aunt Wee's house. The woman at the nearest pump began a conversation, and I noticed that she wore a Yale t-shirt. "Did you go to Yale?" I asked. "No," she replied, "but my nephew does. Do you?" I wasn't sure what to say. It was stupid. Her nephew went to school there, for Christ's sake. But I was still uncomfortable admitting that I'd become an Ivy Leaguer. The moment she told me that her nephew went to Yale, I had to choose. Was I a Yale law student, or was I a Middletown kid with hillbilly grandparents? If the former, I could exchange pleasantries and talk about New Haven's beauty. If the latter, she occupied the other side of an invisible divide and could not be trusted. At her cocktail parties and fancy dinners, she and her nephew probably even laughed about the unsophisticates of Ohio and how they clung to their guns and religion. I would not join forces with her. My answer was a pathetic attempt at cultural defiance. "No, I don't go to Yale, but my girlfriend does." And then I got in my car and drove away. This wasn't one of my prouder moments, but it highlights the inner conflict inspired by rapid upward mobility. I had lied to a stranger to avoid feeling like a traitor. There are lessons to draw here, among them what I've noted already, that one consequence of isolation is seeing standard metrics of success as not just unattainable, but as the property of people not like us. Mamaw always fought that attitude in me, and for the most part, she was successful. Another lesson is that it's not just our own communities that reinforce the outsider attitude. It's the places and people that upward mobility connects us with, like my professor who suggested that Yale Law School shouldn't accept applicants from non-prestigious state schools. There's no way to quantify how these attitudes affect the working class. We do know that working class Americans aren't just less likely to climb the economic ladder, they're also more likely to fall off even after they've reached the top. I imagine that the discomfort they feel at leaving behind much of their identity plays at least a small role in this problem. One way our upper class can promote upward mobility, then, is not only by pushing wise public policies, but by opening their hearts and minds to the newcomers who don't quite belong. Though we sing the praises of social mobility, it has its downsides. The term necessarily implies a sort of movement, to a theoretically better life, yes, but also away from something. And you can't always control the parts of your old life from which you drift. In the past few years, I've vacationed in Panama and England. I've bought my groceries at Whole Foods. I've watched orchestral concerts. I've tried to break my addiction to refined processed sugars, a term that includes at least one too many words. I've worried about racial prejudice in my own family and friends. None of these things is bad on its own. In fact, most of them are good. Visiting England was a childhood dream. Eating less sugar improves health. At the same time, they've shown me that social mobility isn't just about money and economics. It's about a lifestyle change. The wealthy and the powerful aren't just wealthy and powerful. they follow a different set of norms and mores. When you go from working class to professional class, almost everything about your old life becomes unfashionable at best, or unhealthy at worst. At no time was this more obvious than the first, and last, time I took a Yale friend to Cracker Barrel. In my youth, it was the height of fine dining, my grandma's and my favorite restaurant. With Yale friends, it was a greasy public health crisis. These aren't exactly major problems, and if given the option all over again, I'd trade a bit of social discomfort for the life I lead in a heartbeat. But as I realized that in this new world I was the cultural alien, I began to think seriously about questions that had nagged at me since I was a teenager. Why has no one else from my high school made it to the Ivy League? Why are people like me so poorly represented in America's elite institutions? Why is domestic strife so common in families like mine? Why did I think that places like Yale and Harvard were so unreachable? Why did successful people feel so different? Chapter 13. As I began to think a bit more deeply about my own identity, I fell hard for a classmate of mine named Usha. As luck would have it, we were assigned as partners for our first major writing assignment, so we spent a lot of time during that first year getting to know each other. She seemed some sort of genetic anomaly, a combination of every positive quality a human being should have. Bright, hardworking, tall, and beautiful. I joked with a buddy that if she had possessed a terrible personality, she would have made an excellent heroine in an Ayn Rand novel. But she had a great sense of humor and an extraordinarily direct way of speaking. Where others might have asked meekly, "Yeah, maybe you could rephrase this," or "Have you thought about this other idea?" Usha would say simply, "I think this sentence needs work," or "This is a pretty terrible argument." At a bar, she looked up at a mutual friend of ours and said, without a hint of irony, "You have a very small head." I had never met anyone like her. I had dated other girls before, some serious, some not, but Usha occupied an entirely different emotional universe. I thought about her constantly. One friend described me as heartsick, and another told me he had never seen me like this. Toward the end of our first year, I learned that Usha was single, and I immediately asked her out. After a few weeks of flirtations and a single date, I told her that I was in love with her. It violated every rule of modern dating I'd learned as a young man, but I didn't care. Usha was like my Yale spirit guide. She'd attended the university for college, too, and knew all of the best coffee shops and places to eat. Her knowledge went much deeper, however. She instinctively understood the questions I didn't even know to ask, and she always encouraged me to seek opportunities that I didn't know existed. "Go to office hours," she'd tell me. "Professors here like to engage with students. It's part of the experience here." In a place that always seemed a little foreign, Usha's presence made me feel at home. I went to Yale to earn a law degree, but that first year at Yale taught me most of all that I didn't know how the world worked. Every August, recruiters from prestigious law firms descend on New Haven, hungry for the next generation of high-quality legal talent. The students call it FIP, short for Fall Interview Program, and it's a marathon week of dinners, cocktail hours, hospitality suite visits, and interviews. On my first day of FIP, just before second-year classes began, I had 6 interviews, including one with the firm I most coveted, Gibson, Dunn & Crusher, LLP, Gibson Dunn for short, which had an elite practice in Washington, D.C. The interview with Gibson Dunn went well, and I was invited to their infamous dinner at one of New Haven's fanciest restaurants. The rumor mill informed me that the dinner was a kind of intermediate interview. We needed to be funny, charming, and engaging, or we'd never be invited to the D.C. or New York offices for final interviews. When I arrived at the restaurant, I thought it a pity that the most expensive meal I'd ever eaten would take place in such a high-stakes environment. Before dinner, we were all corralled into a private banquet room for wine and conversation. Women a decade older than I was carried around wine bottles wrapped in beautiful linens, asking every few minutes whether I wanted a new glass of wine or a refill on the old one. At first, I was too nervous to drink, but I finally mustered the courage to answer yes when someone asked whether I'd like some wine, and if so, what kind. "I'll take the white," I said, which I thought would settle the matter. "Would you like Sauvignon Blanc or Chardonnay?" I thought she was screwing with me, but I used my powers of deduction to determine that those were two separate kinds of white wine. So I ordered a Chardonnay, not because I didn't know what Sauvignon Blanc was, though I didn't, but because it was easier to pronounce. I had just dodged my first bullet. The night, however, was young. At these types of events, you have to strike a balance between shy and overbearing. You don't want to annoy the partners, but you don't want them to leave without shaking your hand. I tried to be myself. I've always considered myself gregarious, but not oppressive. But I was so impressed by the environment that being myself meant staring slack-jawed at the fineries of the restaurant and wondering how much they cost. The wine glasses look like they've been Windexed. That dude did not buy his suit at the 3 suits for 1 sale at Jose Bank. It looks like it's made from silk. The linens on the table look softer than my bedsheets. I need to touch them without being weird about it. Long story short, I needed a new plan. By the time we sat down for dinner, I'd resolved to focus on the task at hand, getting a job, and leave the class tourism for later. My bearing lasted another 2 minutes. After we sat down, the waitress asked whether I'd like tap or sparkling water. I rolled my eyes at that one. As impressed as I was with the restaurant, calling the water sparkling was just too pretentious, like sparkling crystal or a sparkling diamond. But I ordered the sparkling water anyway. Probably better for me. Fewer contaminants. I took one sip and literally spit it out. It was the grossest thing I'd ever tasted. I remember once getting a Diet Coke at a Subway without realizing that the fountain machine didn't have enough Diet Coke syrup. That's exactly what this fancy place's sparkling water tasted like. "Something's wrong with the water," I protested. The waitress apologized and told me she'd get me another Pellegrino. That was when I realized that sparkling water meant carbonated water. I was mortified, but luckily only one other person noticed what had happened, and she was a classmate. I was in the clear, no more mistakes. Immediately thereafter, I looked down at the place setting and observed an absurd number of instruments. 9 utensils? Why, I wondered, did I need 3 spoons? Why were there multiple butter knives? Then I recalled a scene from a movie and realized there was some social convention surrounding the placement and size of the cutlery. I excused myself to the restroom and called my spirit guide. What do I do with all these damn forks? I don't want to make a fool of myself. Armed with Usha's reply, go from outside to inside, and don't use the same utensil for separate dishes. Oh, and use the fat spoon for soup. I returned to dinner, ready to dazzle my future employers. The rest of the evening was uneventful. I chatted politely and remembered Lindsay's admonition to chew with my mouth closed. Those at our table talked about law and law school, firm culture, and even a little politics. The recruiters we ate with were very nice, and everyone at my table landed a job offer, even the guy who spit out his sparkling water. It was at this meal, on the 1st of 5 grueling days of interviews, that I began to understand that I was seeing the inner workings of a system that lay hidden to most of my kind. Our career office had emphasized the importance of sounding natural and being someone the interviewers wouldn't mind sitting with on an airplane. It made perfect sense. After all, who wants to work with an asshole? But it seemed an odd emphasis for what felt like the most important moment of a young career. Our interviews weren't so much about grades or resumes, we were told. Thanks to a Yale Law pedigree, one foot was already in the door. The interviews were about passing a social test, a test of belonging, of holding your own in a corporate boardroom, of making connections with potential future clients. The most difficult test was the one I wasn't even required to take, getting an audience in the first place. All week, I marveled at the ease of access to the most esteemed lawyers in the country. All of my friends had at least a dozen interviews, and most led to job offers. I had 16 when the week began, though by the end I was so spoiled and exhausted by the process that I turned down a couple of interviews. 2 years earlier, I had applied to dozens of places in the hope of landing a well-paying job after college, but was rebuffed every time. Now, after only a year at Yale Law, my classmates and I were being handed 6-figure salaries by men who had argued before the United States Supreme Court. It was pretty clear that there was some mysterious force at work, and I had just tapped into it for the first time. I had always thought that when you needed a job, you look online for job postings, and then you submit a dozen resumes, and then you hope that someone calls you back. If you're lucky, maybe a friend puts your resume at the top of the pile. If you're qualified for a very high-demand profession, like accounting, maybe the job search comes a bit easier, but the rules are basically the same. The problem is, virtually everyone who plays by those rules fails. That week of interviews showed me that successful people are playing an entirely different game. They don't flood the job market with resumes, hoping that some employer will grace them with an interview. They network. They email a friend of a friend to make sure their name gets the look it deserves. They have their uncles call old college buddies. They have their school's career service office set up interviews months in advance on their behalf. They have parents tell them how to dress, what to say, and whom to schmooze. That doesn't mean the strength of your resume or interview performance is irrelevant. Those things certainly matter. But there is enormous value in what economists call social capital. It's a professor's term, but the concept is pretty simple. The networks of people and institutions around us have real economic value. They connect us to the right people, ensure that we have opportunities, and impart valuable information. Without them, we're going it alone. I learned this the hard way during one of my final interviews of the Marathon FIP week. At that point, the interviews were like a broken record. People asked about my interests, my favorite classes, my expected legal specialty. Then they asked if I had any questions. After a dozen tries, my answers were polished, and my questions made me sound like a seasoned consumer of law firm information. The truth was that I had no idea what I wanted to do, and no idea what field of law I expected to practice in. I wasn't even sure what my questions about firm culture and work-life balance meant. The whole process was a little more than a dog and pony show, but I didn't seem like an asshole, so I was coasting. Then I hit a wall. The last interviewer asked me a question I was unprepared to answer. Why did I want to work for a law firm? It was a softball, but I'd gotten so used to talking about my budding interest in antitrust litigation, an interest that was at least a little fabricated, that I was laughably unprepared. I should have said something about learning from the best or working on high-stakes litigation. I should have said anything other than what came from my mouth. I don't really know, but the pay isn't bad, huh? The interviewer looked at me like I had three eyes, and the conversation never recovered. I was certain I was toast. I had flubbed the interview in the worst way. But behind the scenes, one of my recommenders was already working the phones. She told the hiring partner that I was a smart, good kid and would make an excellent lawyer. She raved about you, I later heard. So when the recruiters called to schedule the next round of interviews, I made the cut. I eventually got the job, despite failing miserably at what I perceived was the most important part of the recruiting process. The old adage says that it's better to be lucky than good. Apparently having the right network is better than both. At Yale, networking power is like the air we breathe, so pervasive that it's easy to miss. Toward the end of our first year, most of us were studying for the Yale Law Journal writing competition. The journal publishes lengthy pieces of legal analysis, mostly for an academic audience. The articles read like radiator manuals, dry, formulaic, and partially written in another language, a sampling. Despite grading's great promise, we show that the regulatory design, implementation, and practice suffer from serious flaws. Jurisdictions fudge more than nudge. Kidding aside, journal membership is serious business. It is the single most significant extracurricular activity for legal employers, some of whom hire only from the publication's editorial board. Some kids came to the law school with a plan for admission to the Yale Law Journal. The writing competition kicked off in April. By March, some people were weeks into preparation. On the advice of recent graduates, who were also close friends, a good friend had begun studying before Christmas. The alumni of elite consulting firms gathered together to grill each other on editorial techniques. One second-year student helped his old Harvard roommate, a first-year student, design a study strategy for the final months before the test. At every turn, people were tapping into friendship circles and alumni groups to learn about the most important test of our first year. I had no idea what was going on. There was no Ohio State alumni group. When I arrived, I was one of two Ohio State graduates at the entire law school. I suspected the journal was important because Supreme Court Justice Sonia Sotomayor had been a member. But I didn't know why. I didn't even know what the journal did. The entire process was a black box, and no one I knew had the key. There were official channels of information, but they telegraphed conflicting messages. Yale prides itself on being a low-stress, non-competitive law school, Unfortunately, that ethos sometimes manifests itself in confused messaging. No one seemed to know what value the credential actually held. We were told that the journal was a huge career boost, but that it wasn't that important. That we shouldn't stress about it, but that it was a prerequisite for certain types of jobs. This was undoubtedly true. For many career paths and interests, journal membership was merely wasted time. But I didn't know which career paths that applied to, and I was unsure how to find out. It was around this time that Amy Chua, one of my professors, stepped in and told me exactly how things worked. Journal membership is useful if you want to work for a judge or if you want to be an academic. Otherwise, it's a waste. But if you're unsure what you want to do, go ahead and try out. It was million-dollar advice. Because I was unsure what I wanted, I followed it. Though I didn't make it during my first year, I made the cut during my second year and became an editor of the prestigious publication. Whether I made it isn't the point. What mattered was that, with a professor's help, I had closed the information gap. It was like I'd learned to see. This wasn't the last time Amy helped me navigate unfamiliar terrain. Law school is a 3-year obstacle course of life and career decisions. On the one hand, it's nice to have so many opportunities. On the other hand, I had no idea what to do with those opportunities or any clue which opportunities serve some long-term goal. Hell, I didn't even have a long-term goal. I just wanted to graduate and get a good job. I had some vague notion that I'd like to do public service after I repaid my law school debt, but I didn't have a job in mind. Life didn't wait. Almost immediately after I committed to a law firm, people started talking about clerkship applications for after graduation. Judicial clerkships are 1-year stints with federal judges. It's a fantastic learning experience for young lawyers. Clerks read court filings, research legal issues for a judge, and even help the judge draft opinions. Every former clerk raves about the experience, and private sector employers often shell out tens of thousands in signing bonuses for recent clerks. That's what I knew about clerkships, and it was completely true. It was also very superficial. The clerkship process is infinitely more complex. First, you have to decide what kind of court you want to work for, a court that does a lot of trials, or a court that hears appeals from lower courts. Then, you have to decide which regions of the country to apply to. If you want to clerk for the Supreme Court, certain feeder judges give you a greater chance of doing so. Predictably, those judges hire more competitively, so holding out for a feeder judge carries certain risks. If you win the game, you're halfway to the chambers of the nation's highest court. If you lose, you're stuck without a clerkship. Sprinkled on top of these factors is the reality that you work closely with these judges, and no one wants to waste a year getting berated by an asshole in black robes. There's no database that spits out this information, no central source that tells you which judges are nice, which judges send people to the Supreme Court, and which type of work, trial or appellate, you want to do. In fact, it's considered almost unseemly to talk about these things. How do you ask a professor if the judge he's recommending you to is a nice lady? It's trickier than it might seem. So to get this information, you have to tap into your social network, student groups, friends who have clerked, and the few professors who are willing to give brutally honest advice. By this point in my law school experience, I had learned that the only way to take advantage of networking was to ask. So I did. Amy Chua told me that I shouldn't worry about clerking for a prestigious feeder judge because the credential wouldn't prove very useful given my ambitions. But I pushed until she relented and agreed to recommend me to a high-powered federal judge with deep connections to multiple Supreme Court justices. I submitted all the materials, a resume, a polished writing sample, and a desperate letter of interest. I didn't know why I was doing it. Maybe, with my southern drawl and lack of a family pedigree, I felt like I needed proof that I belonged at Yale Law. Or maybe I was just following the herd. Regardless of the reason, I needed to have this credential. A few days after I submitted my materials, Amy called me into her office to let me know that I had made the shortlist. My heart fluttered. I knew that all I needed was an interview and I'd get the job. And I knew that if she pushed my application hard enough, I'd get the interview. That was when I learned the value of real social capital. I don't mean to suggest that my professor picked up the phone and told the judge that he had to give me an interview. Before she did that, my professor told me that she wanted to talk to me very seriously. She turned downright somber. I don't think you're doing this for the right reasons. I think you're doing this for the credential, which is fine, but the credential doesn't actually serve your career goals. If you don't want to be a high-powered Supreme Court litigator, you shouldn't care that much about this job. She then told me how hard a clerkship with this judge would be. He was demanding to the extreme. His clerks didn't take a single day off for an entire year. Then she got personal. She knew I had a new girlfriend and that I was crazy about her. This clerkship is the type of thing that destroys relationships. If you want my advice, I think you should prioritize Usha and figure out a career move that actually suits you. It was the best advice anyone has ever given me, and I took it. I told her to withdraw my application. It's impossible to say whether I would have gotten the job. I was probably being overconfident. My grades and resume were fine, but not fantastic. However, Amy's advice stopped me from making a life-altering decision. It prevented me from moving 1,000 miles away from the person I eventually married. Most important, it allowed me to accept my place at this unfamiliar institution. It was okay to chart my own path, and okay to put a girl above some short-sighted ambition. My professor gave me permission to be me. It's hard to put a dollar value on that advice. It's the kind of thing that continues to pay dividends. But make no mistake, the advice had tangible economic value. Social capital isn't manifest only in someone connecting you to a friend or passing a resume on to an old boss. It is also, or perhaps primarily, a measure of how much we learn through our friends, colleagues, and mentors. I didn't know how to prioritize my options, and I didn't know that there were other, better paths for me. I learned these things through my network, specifically a very generous professor. My education in social capital continues. For a time, I contributed to the website of David Frum, the journalist and opinion leader who now writes for The Atlantic. When I was ready to commit to one D.C. law firm, he suggested another firm where two of his friends from the Bush administration had recently taken senior partnerships. One of those friends interviewed me and, when I joined his firm, became an important mentor. I later ran into this man at a Yale conference where he introduced me to his old buddy from the Bush White House and my political hero, Indiana Governor Mitch Daniels. Without David's advice, I never would have found myself at that firm, nor would I have spoken, albeit briefly, to the public figure I most admired. I did decide that I wanted to clerk, but instead of walking into the process blindly, I came to know what I wanted out of the experience, to work for someone I respected, to learn as much as I could, and to be close to Usha. So Usha and I decided to go through the clerkship process together. We landed in northern Kentucky, not far from where I grew up. It was the best possible situation. We liked our judicial bosses so much that we asked them to officiate our wedding. This is just one version of how the world of successful people actually works. But social capital is all around us. Those who tap into it and use it prosper. Those who don't are running life's race with a major handicap. This is a serious problem for kids like me. Here's a non-exhaustive list of the things I didn't know when I got to Yale Law School. That you needed to wear a suit to a job interview. That wearing a suit large enough to fit a silverback gorilla was inappropriate. That a butter knife wasn't just decorative. After all, anything that requires a butter knife can be done better with a spoon or an index finger. That pleather and leather were different substances. That your shoes and belt should match. That certain cities and states had better job prospects. That going to a nicer college brought benefits outside of bragging rights. That finance was an industry that people worked in. Mamaw always resented the hillbilly stereotype, the idea that our people were a bunch of slobbering morons. But the fact is that I was remarkably ignorant of how to get ahead. Not knowing things that many others do often has serious economic consequences. It cost me a job in college. Apparently, Marine Corps combat boots and khaki pants aren't proper interview attire, and could have cost me a lot more in law school if I hadn't had a few people helping me every step of the way. Chapter 14. As I started my second year of law school, I felt like I'd made it. Fresh off a summer job at the U.S. Senate, I returned to New Haven with a wealth of new friends and experiences. I had this beautiful girlfriend, and I had a great job at a nice law firm almost in hand. I knew that kids like me weren't supposed to get this far, and I congratulated myself for having beaten the odds. I was better than where I came from, better than Mom and her addiction, and better than the father figures who'd walked out on me. I regretted only that Mamaw and Papaw weren't around to see it. But there were signs that things weren't going so well, particularly in my relationship with Usha. We'd been dating for only a few months when she stumbled upon an analogy that described me perfectly. I was, she said, a turtle. Whenever something bad happens, even a hint of disagreement, you withdraw completely. It's like you have a shell that you hide in. It was true. I had no idea how to deal with relationship problems, so I chose not to deal with them at all. I could scream at her when she did something I didn't like, but that seemed mean. Or I could withdraw and get away. Those were the proverbial arrows in my quiver, and I had nothing else. The thought of fighting with her reduced me to a morass of the qualities I thought I hadn't inherited from my family. Stress, sadness, fear, anxiety. It was all there, and it was intense. So I tried to get away, but Usha wouldn't let me. I tried to break everything off multiple times, but she told me that that was stupid unless I didn't care about her. So I'd scream and I'd yell. I'd do all of the hateful things that my mother had done. And then I'd feel guilty and desperately afraid. For so much of my life, I'd made Mom out to be a kind of villain, and now I was acting like her. Nothing compares to the fear that you're becoming the monster in your closet. During that second year of law school, Usha and I traveled to D.C. for follow-up interviews with a few law firms. I returned to our hotel room, dejected that I had just performed poorly with one of the firms I really wanted to work for. When Usha tried to comfort me, to tell me that I'd probably done better than I expected, but that even if I hadn't, there were other fish in the sea, I exploded. "Don't tell me that I did fine," I yelled. "You're just making an excuse for weakness. I didn't get here by making excuses for failure." I stormed out of the room and spent the next couple of hours on the streets of D.C.'s business district. I thought about that time Mom took me and our toy poodle to Middletown's Comfort Inn after a screaming match with Bob. We stayed there for a couple of days until Mamaw convinced Mom that she had to return home and face her problems like an adult. And I thought about Mom during her childhood, running out the back door with her mother and sister to avoid another night of terror with her alcoholic father. I was a third-generation escaper. I was near Ford's Theater, the historic location where John Wilkes Booth shot Abraham Lincoln. About a half block from the theater is a corner store that sells Lincoln memorabilia. In it, a large Lincoln blow-up doll with an extraordinarily large grin gazes at those walking by. I felt like this inflatable Lincoln was mocking me. "Why the hell is he smiling?" I thought. Lincoln was melancholy to begin with. And if any place invoked a smile, surely it wouldn't be a stone's throw away from the place where someone shot him in the head. I turned the corner, and after a few steps I saw Usha sitting on the steps of Ford's Theater. She had run after me, worried about me being alone. I realized then that I had a problem, that I must confront whatever it was that had, for generations, caused those in my family to hurt those whom they loved. I apologized profusely to Usha. I expected her to tell me to go fuck myself, that it would take days to make up for what I'd done, that I was a terrible person. A sincere apology is a surrender, and when someone surrenders, you go in for the kill. But Usha wasn't interested in that. She calmly told me through her tears that it was never acceptable to run away, that she was worried, and that I had to learn how to talk to her. And then she gave me a hug and told me that she accepted my apology and was glad I was okay. That was the end of it. Usha hadn't learned how to fight in the hillbilly school of hard knocks. The first time I visited her family for Thanksgiving, I was amazed at the lack of drama. Usha's mother didn't complain about her father behind his back. There were no suggestions that good family friends were liars or backstabbers, no angry exchanges between a man's wife and the same man's sister. Usha's parents seemed to genuinely like her grandmother and spoke of their siblings with love. When I asked her father about a relatively estranged family member, I expected to hear a rant about character flaws. What I heard instead was sympathy and a little sadness, but primarily a life lesson. I still call him regularly and check up on him. You can't just cast aside family members because they seem uninterested in you. You've got to make the effort because they're family. I tried to go to a counselor, but it was just too weird. Talking to some stranger about my feelings made me want to vomit. I did go to the library, and I learned that behavior I considered commonplace was the subject of pretty intense academic study. Psychologists call the everyday occurrences of my and Lindsay's life adverse childhood experiences, or ACEs. ACEs are traumatic childhood events, and their consequences reach far into adulthood. The trauma need not be physical. The following events or feelings are some of the most common ACEs. Being sworn at, insulted, or humiliated by parents. Being pushed, grabbed, or having something thrown at you. Feeling that your family didn't support each other. Having parents who were separated or divorced. Living with an alcoholic or drug user. Living with someone who is depressed or attempted suicide. Watching a loved one be physically abused. ACEs happen everywhere in every community, but studies have shown that ACEs are far more common in my corner of the demographic world. A report by the Wisconsin Children's Trust Fund showed that among those with a college degree or more, the non-working class, fewer than half had experienced an ACE. Among the working class, well over half had at least one ACE, while about 40% had multiple ACEs. This is really striking. 4 in every 10 working class people had faced multiple instances of childhood trauma. For the non-working class, that number was 29%. I gave a quiz to Aunt Wee, Uncle Dan, Lindsay, and Usha that psychologists use to measure the number of ACEs a person has faced. Aunt Wee scored a 7, higher even than Lindsay and me, who each scored a 6. Dan and Usha, the two people whose families seemed nice to the point of oddity, each scored a 0. The weird people were the ones who hadn't faced any childhood trauma. Children with multiple ACEs are more likely to struggle with anxiety and depression, to suffer from heart disease and obesity, and to contract certain types of cancers. They're also more likely to underperform in school and suffer from relationship instability as adults. Even excessive shouting can damage a kid's sense of security and contribute to mental health and behavioral issues down the road. Harvard pediatricians have studied the effect that childhood trauma has on the mind. In addition to later negative health consequences, the doctors found that constant stress can actually change the chemistry of a child's brain. Stress, after all, is triggered by a physiological reaction. It's the consequence of adrenaline and other hormones flooding our system, usually in response to some kind of stimulus. This is the classic fight or flight response that we learn about in grade school. It sometimes produces incredible feats of strength and bravery from ordinary people. It's how mothers can lift heavy objects when their children are trapped underneath, and how an unarmed elderly woman can fight off a mountain lion with her bare hands to save her husband. Unfortunately, the fight-or-flight response is a destructive constant companion. As Dr. Nadine Burke-Harris put it, the response is great if you're in a forest and there's a bear. The problem is when that bear comes home from the bar every night. When that happens, the Harvard researchers found, the sector of the brain that deals with highly stressful situations takes over. Significant stress in early childhood, they write, results in a hyper-responsive or chronically activated physiologic stress response, along with increased potential for fear and anxiety. For kids like me, the part of the brain that deals with stress and conflict is always activated, the switch flipped indefinitely. We are constantly ready to fight or flee because there is constant exposure to the bear, whether that bear is an alcoholic dad or an unhinged mom. We become hardwired for conflict, and that wiring remains even when there's no more conflict to be had. It's not just fighting. By almost any measure, American working-class families experience a level of instability unseen elsewhere in the world. Consider, for instance, mom's revolving door of father figures. No other country experiences anything like this. In France, the percentage of children exposed to 3 or more maternal partners is 0.5%, about 1 in 200. The second highest share is 2.6%, in Sweden, or about 1 in 40. In the United States, the figure is a shocking 8.2%, about 1 in 12, and the figure is even higher in the working class. The most depressing part is that relationship instability, like home chaos, is a vicious cycle. As sociologists Paula Formby and Andrew Trulin found, a growing body of literature suggests that children who experience multiple transitions in family structure may